The Spirit of God, like fire, is burning. Latter-day glory begins to come forth.
Project Zion Podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. We aim to feature a wide variety of guests and panelists with roots in the Restoration tradition from Community of Christ and our friends in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The music has been provided by Mark Abernathy. You can find his music at www.mark-abernathy.com. Glory to them.
Welcome to another Faith Transitions podcast. I'm your host, Rob, aka Rob Vox.
I'm your host, Nancy. Faith Transitions is here to create a safe space for people to wrestle with faith and doubt by sharing their faith journey and achieve solidarity and strength in a community of support. Welcome back to another episode of the Faith Transitions podcast. We're here today with Katie Langston, who is a divinity student. Hi, Katie.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here. And we've also got Rob, my co-host.
Yes. Welcome back to Faith Transitions, everybody.
And so I've been looking forward to this one. I love Katie because she's great. And so, Katie, I'm wondering if we could just kind of jump right in. And if you could kind of describe your childhood and your family structure and what role faith played in your household.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, faith was an extremely important aspect of my growing up, and I am the oldest of five kids. There are four girls and one boy, poor guy, and we were raised in a very, very devout Mormon home, and my parents, around the time that I was made, was you know, I turned maybe, I don't know, I was somewhere around 8, 9, 10, somewhere in there. My parents my parents are very conservative, and they have always been pretty conservative, at least for as long as I've been alive. I think that they, you know, had maybe a little bit more fun in college than they like to let on. since they got together and started their family and so on, they were always very conservative. But around that time, they started getting into what I would call really quasi-fundamentalist. Definitely fundamentalist from the standpoint that it was ultra-literalistic, you know, super-duper conservative, like, you know, that so it's fundamentalist if you're talking about sort of the broader landscape of Christianity or even, you know, religion and using that term. Not fundamentalist in the Mormon sense of the word, where they were like polygamists or something like that. Although they did have a good friend go that way. So that was sort of the circles they were kind of running in. And they pulled me out of public school and decided to homeschool me. And then, like I said, I'm the oldest. So my younger siblings who were alive at that time and then who came along later, I think there were three of us at that time. And then, you know, by the time they were finished having their family, there are five of us. But it became like super serious. And I know that it wasn't just the religious thing that, you know, caused them to homeschool. I know that part of it had to do with, I was being bullied in school. I don't have too many memories of being bullied, but my mom certainly has some strong memories of me coming home in tears and with mud on, you know, on my clothes, and kids, older kids having like stolen my cupcakes that I brought for my birthday one year, you know, in the middle, at the very beginning of third grade and that kind of thing. So I know that was part of it too, but I really do think that probably the driving force behind that decision, at least at the time that they decided to begin homeschooling, was like just the sense that the world was like too scary and too bad, and that the end was imminent. And so I grew up with a lot of fear. I internalized that in a very like scared, fearful way. I remember, you know, many nights praying to God, you know, praying to Heavenly Father that he would like wait to send the second coming, because I didn't want to be swallowed up in the fire, you know, that would engulf the earth and everyone in it. And I wasn't sure that, you know, my 9-year-old self would be worthy enough to make it. You know what I mean?
Wow. So, was there a lot of like apocalyptic imagery then kind of discussed in your home?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we had the year supply and, you know, there was just the sense that the second coming was around the corner. And, you know, I mean, and they did like, you know, for a while, I mean, they were into some kind of goofy stuff, and they look back on it now. I mean, you know, they look back on it now and like admit that it was kind of goofy, but like, you know, like my mom wouldn't let us listen to any pop music because it had, you know, she had a, what she, they called, I don't know who they are, but the people that she was listening to, you know, said it had a double beat. Huh. I don't even know what that means. Huh. Like she couldn't even describe it, what that means. But like, if it had a double beat, then like Satan could like be in the music. And like, so just some very, you know, we learned history in homeschool, and like literally our history lesson was like, okay, 6000 BC was the creation. And, you know, in 3333 BC was Enoch, and the city of Enoch was translated. So, you know what I'm saying? Like just super duper way literalistic stuff.
Can we ask you, where were you located geographically? Sure. Just give us a rough region or something.
Yeah. I grew up in, for that part, I grew up two places. I grew up till I was about 11 or 12, we lived in Magna, Utah, which is like kind of by West Valley City. And then after that, we moved up to Logan and Cache Valley. And I lived in Cache Valley until after my marriage and, you know, got married in the Logan Temple and went to Utah State and all that good stuff. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. And for those listeners who are tuning in maybe outside of the Mormon tradition, it sounds like all of this is within the LDS realm, the Mormon tradition, all of the kind of anxiety around Mormon doctrine. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. So walk us up a little farther through adolescence, maybe early young adulthood, et cetera, up through college, how your faith was a part of your life, and then where maybe some of your first challenges come from.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so like I say, I internalized that stuff, you know, pretty seriously and had a lot of fear. And in fact, I developed scrupulosity or OCD around religious issues. So from the time I was probably 9 or 10 or something like that, I had like a confession compulsion because all of my anxiety like revolved around issues of faith. And so like, I remember like one example that's, I think is a really good one, is one time my mom was like, who stole, like dad had 50 cents on the dresser. And, you know, she's like, who took it? Cause now it's gone. And like, you know, like 97% sure, like looking back, it was almost certainly my brother.
Right.
And I'm going to throw him under the bus now, you know, 25 years later, but Neil, right, it was you. Yeah, right. I know it was. But anyway, I didn't know what happened to it, but I wasn't sure that it wasn't me. You know what I mean?
Right.
And OCD does that. Like it like tells you like, oh, it's weird, you know? And it makes your mind do kind of weird things. So I remember just like for days and days and days, just like, what if I stole that money and I don't know? What if I did and I don't know? And so eventually I confessed to my mother that I had taken, I had taken the 50 cents, like just to be sure, you know, like my thought process was like, well, I'm not sure if I did or I didn't, but like, just to be safe so that I'm not in trouble with God, I better like confess. And so those sorts of things, whether I did something or didn't do something, if I said a swear word, if, you know, any number of things, I felt like I had to confess those things, to my mother. And, poor dear, like she, even now that we've sort of sorted through it, you know, she says to me, she's like, I had no idea what to do with you, but she caught on. Like I would say to her, you know, she would say, who did XYZ? And I would be like, I'm not sure, but it might have been me. And my mom, you know, she figured it out. She was like, it wasn't you. So that was nice.
Right.
But that, you know, that was a part of my life and we didn't know what it was. Like, we had no idea that, you know, my mom knew it was weird. I didn't particularly know it was weird because it was just my experience, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I was a kid. She knew it was weird, but she didn't know that it might be like a thing, you know. And so that kind of followed me all throughout adolescence. You know, when I became a high school junior and senior, it kind of went away, and it tends to do that. If you look at, you know, at the research, oftentimes there's a bit of a reprieve in adolescence. And so that was really nice. I had a lot of friends in high school, and it was a great time. I was in the drama I was the drama club president at Logan High School, and I, you know, was on the debate and the mock trial team and had lots of friends, and actually had a large, you know, as diverse a group of friends as you could probably have in a, you know, college town in northern Utah. But a lot of the university professors' kids went to my high school, and a lot of them were involved in, like, you know, debate and drama and those sorts of things. So we had kids, you know, my group of friends had, you know, there were lots of Mormon kids, of course, but then there were some, you know, Protestant Christian kids, and you know, we had some friends who were Hindu and some friends who were Jewish, and we had I'm not going to say there was a lot of diversity because it was Logan, Utah, but like as much diversity as you could maybe have in Logan, Utah, like, was our little group of friends.
So can I just stop you for a second?
Yeah.
So you talked about, so if we can just rewind just a little bit. Sure. You talked about, you know, your parents pulling you out of school and maybe fears that the world was just too bad and it was going to swallow you up or have this terrible influence on you. So at what point then was it okay for you to go back to school?
Right. Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad that you brought that up because I totally missed that part of the story, that thread. So around high school, that was kind of had always been their plan, actually, because understanding that, you know, they couldn't provide the activities that they have in high school, and they couldn't provide some of those extracurriculars that would be important on, like, college applications and things like that.
Right.
They had always sort of planned to send us back to school in high school. And in fact, I was part-time in high school for a year and a half or so. And then after my, in the middle of my sophomore year, it might have even been after my sophomore year, I was like, okay, I'm just going to go back to school, you know, the whole time. But actually, I didn't have enough credits technically to graduate because of it. So I ended up taking the GED.
Oh, wow.
To have my, which was funny because I was actually like a Sterling Scholar in speech and debate and like had a GED. So it was really kind of an odd combination, I remember.
Well, and before you work back up to where you're going, what was your worship like through this era as well? What was your Sunday worship, spirituality, other than the preparations for the end times kind of thing, as things evened out maybe and you go into high school? How did that all play out as well?
Well, I think that my parents, you know, they really hit their peak of what they would probably, like I say, even look back on themselves and realize was maybe not like the most healthy or wise, you know, way to approach their faith. That really hit their peak for a couple of years, like when I was a tween, if you want to say that.
Right.
Yeah.
But then by the time, you know, soon after we moved to Logan, and actually that was around the time that their friends became fundamentalists and I like polygamists. By that, I mean polygamists. And I think that was probably a shock to them. And I think probably a combination of factors sort of brought them back to the middle ground in the church, you know, and they're still very conservative, and the Mormon church is a very conservative church. So it's not like, you know, they became a bastion of liberalism in my home or something like that, but it stabilized. And so we were just, I mean, I think we were pretty, like, for the most part, like, pretty normal Mormon family that took the faith extremely seriously. So we'd go to church every Sunday, and you know, we tried to do family home evening and have family prayers, and you know, read the scriptures together, and you know, they had us go to mutual. You know, by the time we I turned 16 or 17, I was too busy. I was working and I was in a billion clubs and doing plays and all kinds of stuff. So,
and describe what mutual is for folks out there.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, mutual is weekly youth activities for Mormon kids, for Mormon youth, like ages 12 to 18.
Right.
So they do them usually on Tuesday or Wednesday nights. And, you know, I, for the most part, went until I got too busy in my senior and junior and senior years of high school and, you know, was in plays and stuff all the time. But, you know, no R-rated movies and coffee.
So can I ask you, were you aware at the time of your family's transitioning from maybe a more extreme place within Mormonism to a more central place?
Like, could you feel that? I don't know how reflective I was about it at the time. Looking back, it's clear that that happened. But I don't know if I could have, if you would have asked me if I would have described the narrative that way at the time.
So, yeah, keep going with up through post high school, I think.
Sure.
Yeah, probably.
Right, right. So, gosh, this is a story I wasn't planning to tell, but this is, so this kind of illustrates where I was at the time. So my senior year of high school, I was nominated as a presidential scholar in the arts in acting, in drama, and had applied and auditioned for the University of Utah's actor training program, which is, you know, like it's a pretty decent program.
Right.
At least it was at the time. I don't know how it is anymore. And was about to, you know, it was in that, you know, last, you know, couple of semesters of, or trimesters, I guess, of high school, and was getting prepared to go to Salt Lake and study theater there. When I don't, you guys probably were not clued into this at all, but there was a lawsuit that took place where, Christy Flynn, I don't know if you can say names. I mean, it was in the papers, so you probably can.
Right.
But Christy Flynn, who's the daughter of Michael Flynn, who's been in a bunch of church movies, like he plays Pontius Pilate in The Lamb of God, the Mormon Easter movie. She sued the University of Utah's theater department because they basically, as part of like their artistic work, like wouldn't let her not do like cut out like swear words.
Yeah,
like the
F word.
I think I remember that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember this? Okay.
Yes.
This sounds vaguely familiar. Yeah.
Yeah. So my dad is friends with Michael Flynn because my dad, he was a theater major and an actor in college and still dabbles. And so he was like, you need to call her and talk to her. And so I called her and I talked to her and I had a scholarship and I turned it down.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
I was like,
as a result of the case, kind of?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing I know about that case is that she lost on appeal or something.
She did lose.
Yeah.
Yeah, she did lose. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably rightfully so. I don't know. But I was like, well, I don't want to say the F word and I don't want to take the name of God in vain. So I'm not going to go to school there. And so ended up kind of floating for a semester after graduation and ended up, you know, I actually applied to BYU and did not get in, which thank God for that. That would be, I have a whole different story now.
I just have to interrupt and say, I feel like a good share of our podcasts so far are like bad BYU stories.
Not intentionally so.
We did not plan it that way, but like that's kind of, so we're kind of veering away from that direction.
Yeah, so the hit squad from the Y, it's not, we did not plan this.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right, right. No. Who knows? Yeah, your narrative may have completely changed.
I can't even imagine. I mean, I'm grateful. No offense, BYU people, but y'all are crazy. it's a crazy place. I'm glad I didn't go there.
Yeah.
Would not have been good for my mindset, you know,
right.
And my particular collection of issues. But anyway, so I ended up just going to Utah State right there at home. I did move out and had a blast. I loved every minute of my time at Utah State. It was the perfect place for someone like me to go, because it's like there are still a lot of Mormon kids, so I felt like safe, you know, coming out of the fairly, you know, devout and conservative upbringing that I had. But it's like also everyone's like also pretty chill and like just likes to have fun. And I had just a wonderful time in the theater department. I've made lifelong friends that I'm still best friends with to this day. Just had just a wonderful, wonderful time for like 2.5 years. And then I decided that I wanted to go on a mission. And then all hell broke loose.
And how old are you? Sorry, can we just ask you, just so you can tell our listeners, how old are you?
Yeah,
when you
I was 21, and I decided to serve a mission the summer before my 21st birthday. My birthday is in November. Mm-hmm. So the OCD came back. Mm. It had been pretty like dormant. Like there were pockets, you know, there were moments like of guilt, like especially like if I made out with a boy or something, then I feel like really guilty about it, but like not too guilty and be like, it's fine, like it's normal, you know. Once I decided to serve a mission, it was like something changed in my outlook and something changed in my mind, and it came back with a vengeance. And the months leading up to my preparation to serve, I served in Bulgaria, the end of 2002 to the middle of 2004, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. December of 2002, yeah, to July 2004. And I remember like I was tormented. I can't even describe it. Like any little memory of any little sin I might have committed like 20 years ago, you know, I was 20 at the time. So like 10 years ago or, you know, 8 years ago or something like that would come back. And right. I remember confessing things that were not real to bishops. And I remember, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I was just tormented. My dad gave me a blessing, in fact, at one time, and that, for non LDS folks, that's, you know, it's a blessing, but they do it by they lay hands on you and then pronounce a blessing on you. And my dad like cast the devils out of me, which didn't, you know, it wasn't a devil. It was a mental illness, but like, that's how it was. Like I was that tormented. Right. And maybe it was a devil. I don't know. Like, I don't necessarily believe in the devil, but if there is a devil, it's probably like that.
Hmm. Right.
And how long did this follow you? Did it
come
with you to Bulgaria? Was that something you dealt with when you were overseas? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it followed me there. I wondered all the time if I was unworthy. OCD is called the doubting disease. And the reason for that is because at the very bottom of it, you know, if you think about it, like the person who like can't stop washing their hands, it's because they're like, they doubt that their hands are actually clean.
Right.
So it's like, what if, like just what if everything? And so, I doubted the church. I doubted God. I doubted myself. I doubted my worthiness. And of course, all of that doubt, I was sure that because the spirit, right, doesn't work that way. And if you're worthy for the spirit, you won't feel that way. So it always came back on me. So the reason that I'm having these doubts, the reason that I'm feeling this tormented, the reason that I can't seem to get to the bottom of all the things that are driving me crazy must be that I am unworthy, that there are things that I, you know, maybe I can't remember what I did, or maybe it's just the way I am put together, but I am not worthy. And that is why I'm feeling this way.
Right. Right.
So there was never any suggestion by anyone that you had a mental health issue, like at this stage, you know, you're like, cause you're on a college campus and things like counseling are available, but nobody suggests that this might be something else other than like, you know, might not be a spiritual problem, but would be like a mental health problem.
No. And I hit it like really well. You know, I functioned at a high level. And my symptoms are mostly what they call pure obsessional, which means that I don't have like a bunch of external rituals of like hand washing or counting or, you know, nothing that you would notice like odd behaviors. Instead, it's just like my compulsion is to try to outthink the doubt.
Uh-huh.
And so my mind is spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning, or I'm spending lots of time before my mission, like I'm spending lots of time on the internet or in the library or something researching, well, where exactly can a boy touch you? You know what I mean? Like, you know, like all those things but just spending all this time on it, but doing it in such a way that it's very secret and people wouldn't know. Like, I have memories of myself, like inside my mind is like absolutely spinning and my stomach is in knots and I am feeling terrible. But on the outside, I'm laughing and I'm making jokes and I'm seeming very, very carefree. So people didn't know.
And I'm wondering what sources you were going through. You mentioned you went looking for sources on, you know, whatever the problem was, whether it's the touching one or something else. You go to the internet. Were there specific sources that were feeding into your anxiety, or were there places that were actually helpful? Whether it's LDS.org or I don't know, where were you going, and did you ever find solace from anything that you ever found?
I mean, I would find like, and it's sort of the way that it works, but I would find answers like, yeah, say on the church website, like I would type into the church search engine, like, you know, law of chastity or, I mean, whatever. I mean, that was a big one. Like, I really worried about that one. So yeah, it's a good example. So I would type that right in and like, read all the talks on it and be like, okay, I'm fine. But then the next day I would be like, but did I read all the talks and am I sure I'm fine? And I would do it again. So I probably read some of those talks like 100 times. You know what I mean?
Right.
Cause that's just the nature of the thing. That's there's no solace to be found because that's just how it is. That's what it is to have OCD. Like,
right. Right.
Well, there was, we'll get to that. There actually was solace to be found, but it wasn't going to be found in trying to figure out the rules and follow the rules perfectly. So, there were some conflicting ones.
So you're saying
talk might say one thing, but the other would say another.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I was going to say, so reading Soul, Symbols, and Sacraments didn't put you at ease about chastity.
No, it didn't. Yeah. No, it didn't. But I do think that's a nice framing for the issue. Like, it's better than the sin next to murder framing for sure.
Right, right.
But it still stressed me out real bad.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The miracle of forgiveness was the worst.
Yeah.
Not a good book.
Not a good book. Speaking of, and I have some obsessive compulsive tendencies myself. I remember he says somewhere in that text, something like, don't die if you have some major thing that you need to work out, because if you die, you're at jeopardy. Something like that. So,
oh shit.
So somebody else can go and find that and correct me, but there is some part, and I read that on my mission and went, what?
Yeah.
No, okay. Well, keep plugging along. Sorry.
No, you're good. Please ask all the questions. It helps. Yeah.
So what happens on your mission then? Like, how does your mission go?
So my mission was a war. My mission was a war between me fighting this battle, fighting this doubt that I had about myself, fighting the doubt that was arising about the church. You know, I think to a certain extent, I might have gone on my mission to resolve the doubt. And then moments of true grace, you know, like I remember meeting a woman on the street in Sofia, which is the capital city. And she's just completely drunk. And, you know, we're talking to her and, you know, trying to share a message. And she says, I've been a prostitute. Do you even know what that means? She says to us, and we said, yes, and you're loved, you know? And like, And she believed it, you know, and she didn't like join the church or like whatever, but she had a moment where tears welled up in her eyes. And, you know, she did actually come to church a couple times, and I'm sure it wasn't the right landing place for her. That's, you know, we weren't equipped to actually, you know, be a place of nurture for someone in those kinds of dire situations. But there were moments where, you know, I, not through any of my own preparation, not through any of my own understanding, I could connect with people on a real human level, and see God in them, and see what God felt for them, you know, in those moments. And there was something very profound about that, and something that changed me for the better. I had wonderful companions. I love all of the companions that I had. I mean, there's not a single companion there were companions that I had difficulties with at the time, but even, you know, now years later, there's not a single companion that I had on my mission that I don't love with all of my heart. And the other sisters in particular, you know, there weren't a lot of us. Whether or not I serve with them as companions are still, you know, dear friends of mine. Some of my dearest friends, I still, you know, have from my mission. So it was like, and I think that this sort of emerged as the major conflict, you know, in my life, and the real catalyst for my faith transition later on was this battle between the dogma and the rules and the wanting to do everything without any ambiguity and the needing everything to be completely lined up, you know, exactly the way it is, and all the articles that I was reading on LDS.org, you know, and then this space of grace and this place of acceptance and this place of connection and this place of love. And that started on my mission in a really profound way. So it was hell. It was really hard. I was mentally ill for like my whole mission, and it was dark, and I would not ever give it back.
So you had struggles. You were dealing with mental health issues on your mission, yet you did experience moments of profound, extreme grace, as you've described. Mm-hmm. Continue maybe a little further in your story, and where do you first start to have some doubts about your faith, and where does your transition really kind of grip you?
Sure. So after I came home, I got married about a year after I came home, and I had known my husband before the mission. He was a friend of mine in the theater department at Utah State, and he is a hilarious, delightful human being. And just a lovely, lovely person. And, God blessed me with a husband that, I had no business choosing, because I was so young.
Right.
And like, I know yeah. so many people that, you know, I just got super lucky, with him. But we got married, about a year after I came home. We dated for a while and had been friends, like I said, beforehand as well.
Okay.
And, but I was still struggling, you know, I was still struggling with OCD and scrupulosity, and still struggling with doubts, about my faith, but they were not, I wouldn't call them like real doubts. They were kind of OCD doubts, as opposed to, boy, I really need to like look at this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I struggled up until the point that I became pregnant with our first daughter. And that was, I think, oh gosh, maybe like 6 or 8 months after we got married, I became pregnant with Ada.
Hmm.
And then my OCD took a pretty sinister turn, and I started having obsessions about like harming. This is like harming my child, right? I was pregnant, and that's Not an uncommon obsession at all, but right. It was so distressing to me and so beyond anything that I could deal with that I went to therapy. I was like, I cannot be having these thoughts. Like I need to figure out what this is and I need to get some help. So I went to therapy and actually wasn't a lot of help. Went to LDS social services. I'm not saying that every LDS social services therapist is ineffective, but this particular one was like, what you have is a case of Mormon woman perfectionism. Hmm. So she gave me some books to read and some things that were kind of devotional in nature. And really, I had a very serious mental health concern. And she didn't see it. She didn't see it. And it's hard to, I don't want to blame her. Like, it's hard to diagnose pure obsessional OCD in scrupulosity. That can be tricky. Although she was in Utah. It's not like she didn't see this. But anyway, she didn't get it. She didn't get it right. And so she had me read like Believing Christ, and she had me read some of those things, which were quasi-helpful in some ways. Well, they weren't very helpful at all with the OCD itself. But what they were helpful with was it began to open my mind to the idea of grace, because he talks a lot, you know, Stephen Robinson and Believe in Christ talks a lot about that and does it within a Mormon context, which was super important to me at the time. I was not anywhere near any place where I would like even consider something else. You know what I mean?
Right.
And also at the time, Lanny started dialoguing with some evangelical Christians online, which is really unlike him. And he doesn't spend a lot of time in interfaith dialogue or even really thinking too much about faith at all. But for some reason at that period, he was, you know, involved in those conversations. Mm-hmm. And of course the types of evangelical Christians who dialogue with Mormons are counter-cult types. And they are, tend to be, you know, 5-point Calvinists and really conservative, but like way into the whole grace thing, right?
Right.
And so I kind of watched those conversations from afar and I was very interested in them and began to just kind of open my mind a little bit more and more to a world in which grace might exist. I went to Mormon and Evangelical in dialogue with Robert Millett, and now I can't remember the evangelical pastor who at least 10 years ago was going around doing those things. I don't know if he's still involved in that ministry. And hearing Robert Millett talk about grace again really opened my mind to begin to embrace it. And I think that in that process, over maybe about a period of 6 months, as I began to see, well, maybe this is a real thing. I experienced a profound awakening in my heart, and a major paradigm shift where I began to believe, like really believe for the first time in my entire life, that maybe I was okay.
Right.
And that maybe I didn't have to worry so much. And that maybe God just loved me.
Right.
You know? Right. But without condition, you didn't have to follow all the rules perfectly. You could just be loved.
Exactly. Yeah.
And do you attribute that kinda, to, sorry, I just wanted to say,
yeah, go ahead.
Do you attribute that to Millett's work or?
It was a combination. It was a combination of all of those things. And the thing that really, there's a talk I heard, a lecture I heard that really sticks out in my mind as being extremely pivotal to me. And there was, I think it was like the Utah State University Campus Crusade for Christ or something like that had invited a C.S. Lewis scholar to come in and talk. And I always forget his name. And my husband always reminds me of his name. And my husband is so much better at names than I am. And I feel bad. But he came in and he gave a talk on C.S. Lewis's works. And he told this story that just like rocked me to my very core. And he told a story of he himself, the C.S. Lewis scholar, was at a dinner with a bunch of other scholars from a bunch of disciplines. And he was seated next to a woman who, I think she was a biologist. And she said to him, "Now, come on, you know, you're a smart guy. What are you doing with this faith thing? You know, what are you doing with this Christianity thing?" And he said to her, "Well," he said, "I don't know about you, but I'm not perfect." And she laughed, you know, and he said, "Oh, but you see, you just laughed." And she said, "Yeah, well, what, you know, what's wrong with, what does that have to do with anything?" And he said, "I think that's because each of us recognizes that, we're broken, that there's a part of us that isn't whole and isn't fully complete and isn't fully human." And he said, "I'm a Christian because I acknowledge my brokenness and I know that I'm broken. And for some reason, it's only Christ who seems to be able to put it back together." And I had never heard, even in all the talk of grace with the Millet and Robinson and those sorts of things, I had never heard someone say, "I'm broken and I, like, deeply broken, and I can only do this with Christ." And I felt that so deeply in my core. I felt so broken and so lost and so anxious and so confused. Why was I so anxious? And just, and the idea that maybe that was okay to be broken, and maybe that was part of it, you know?
Yeah.
That was, it was revolutionary for me to not feel like I had to fix it, but that, like, I could just be broken and didn't have to do anything about it. I could let God do whatever God was going to do about it, but I knew that I could still be loved and, you know, saved, to use that term that was important to me at the time, you know, and it's still important to me, but in a different way. It changed everything. It changed absolutely everything. Then it took me, like, you know, 10 years from there to then figure out, how did Mormonism fit with this new paradigm that I had, and this new, like, acceptance of grace, and this new sense that I didn't have to be perfect? But then why are there worthiness interviews, and why is there this checklist, and, like, why are these policies this way? And so that was the impetus of my true faith crisis, not my OCD crisis, right? Not the compulsive doubts, but the actual doubts, the real doubts, that as I had experienced this one thing, this, like, complete unconditional acceptance of who I was, and I didn't have to do anything at all to earn that or to find it. It came to me, and it came in me, and it held me at my lowest point and changed, you know, and changed me, compared to everything I was hearing every Sunday about do this, don't do that. And if you do this sin, you better go talk to the bishop. And if you don't pay your tithing, you can't, blah, blah, blah. And like, every 2 years, we're going to call you in and make sure that, like, all the thoughts in your head are, like, the right thoughts. And the beverage that you're drinking at your breakfast is the right beverage. And and this idea of worthiness, I was really hung. I just could not reconcile it. I could not reconcile it. It took, and I tried for a really long time. But it, in the end, I could not do it.
You said, okay, so that's probably where we're going. But you said it took 10 years. So how did you? I mean, you don't have to go through every detail of those 10 years, but how, maybe talk about how initially that shift in your focus on grace impacted your worship on Sundays. Because I'm assuming that you were still going every Sunday and involved in a calling in the church and things like that. Your family's all going, kids are involved. So how does that first shift impact you? And then, where do you end up?
Sure. So at first I tried to figure it out within Mormonism. So I spent probably, you know, 5 years on that. Let's say 5 of the 10 I spent on, you know, figuring out, like, reframing Mormonism to, like, work with grace. and it didn't fit super comfortably, but there are strains. There are strains that are quite grace-filled and that are quite beautiful,
right.
In Mormon theology. It's not the dominant strain that you hear coming over the pulpit in general conference or, you know, in the general handbook of instructions or with the practices. But they're there. It is there. And then probably for like a couple, you know, 3 years after that, I started exploring other branches of Christian thought, because there's my experiences have all been very Christocentric. So it's all been within the context, you know, I was changed by Christ and, you know, I deconstructed that, you know, I started, you know, I would go to like other churches and like, I started reading, Brian McLaren and started reading about the emerging church movement and, you know, and postmodernism and, you know, so deconstructed, you know, did a good, healthy, you know, complete deconstruction of not just Mormonism, but like faith in general, and like took it all apart and was like, you know, I don't know about this, but like this Jesus thing, like, is still like a thing for me. Like, I can't get over that one, you know. I can deconstruct it, and it still changed my life. So right. It's still really important to me. Looked into Community of Christ, and still, I mean, I do the podcast Project Zion with the Community of Christ team, like, feel very, you know, indebted to them and their ministry that they've done in my behalf. You know, Robin Linkhart in particular has been a very important mentor to me over the past year or two. But as I explored the Christian landscape and as I, you know, really dug in, I discovered that theologically I just couldn't make it work in Mormonism, and so I moved more toward sort of a generic, maybe Protestant, definitely not evangelical. That went away with the I was talking to a lot of evangelicals for a while, and I still, again, have some great evangelical friends, but like the whole inerrancy of the Bible thing, like I just, with the deconstruction, like that wasn't one that got put back together with the reconstruction.
Right, right.
You know, I was like, eh. And then a couple years ago, I kind of randomly applied to a Lutheran seminary and was accepted, because I knew that I wanted to, you know, I knew that this was more than just a personal process for me, but it felt like there was something God was doing with this, you know, for moving into the future and to be able to take the blessings of grace and of love that God had given me and to share that with other people. And so I didn't know anything about the Lutherans when I applied. Literally, this was my thought process. Oh, look, we're going to move to the Twin Cities, because we knew we were going to move to the Twin Cities because my husband is an actor and there's a good theater scene seat here. So I was like, we're going to move to the Twin Cities. Oh, look, there's a seminary there. It's a Lutheran seminary. I'm going to go look up the Lutherans on the internet. Oh, they don't hate gays. They'll probably accept a Mormon.
It's an interesting metric.
You know, like, they're not going to be like a super.
It worked, apparently, too, right?
Like Bible college, you know?
right.
So and I came here, we moved here a year and a half ago, and, you know, I was still, you know, it's a process. It's not a clean line. At least it hasn't been for me. And then I like started reading Lutheran things, and like Nadia Bolz Weber, if you haven't read
her book, Pastors,
and she just had another one come out, Accidental Saints. I haven't read yet, but
it's great.
She's amazing. And I found out I'm a Lutheran.
Okay.
I found out that like Luther and I had a lot, like Luther, the same things that Luther was mad at the Catholic Church about, I was kind of mad at the Mormon Church for. And like the grace thing and the unconditional, you know, the justification by faith and like all these things, the way that I put together had a very Lutheran feel. I didn't even know that when I was going through the process and when I was like learning to rearticulate my faith. And so it just really resonated with me. And so I've been attending a congregation here for about a year now, that's Lutheran. Kind of marginally Lutheran. They're postmodern-y Lutheran. It's really fun. And then, but we still go to church every Sunday with the LDS ward as well, because that's important to my husband. And we'll raise our girls Mormon because I changed, not him. And that was sort of the agreement going in. So kind of navigating those relationships as well. It's tricky. So I'm not totally out like of Mormonism, you know, still, I'm still a part of the community, but theologically and in terms of probably the way I would articulate my faith, I'm in a different place. So
will that change if and when you're ordained?
I don't know. I don't know what my call to ministry is. I feel called to, I feel called to minister to Mormons. I think that there's a lot of people like me, maybe they didn't have some of the extreme issues of OCD or, you know, sort of the compounding issues that I had. But I think that the big weakness in contemporary Mormonism is the lack of grace. And I think that grace changes everything. And I feel like I really want to share that with Mormon people. And so, and I don't care if they convert out of, like, that's what, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't, it's not about like converting to another thing to like get it right so that you can go to the right place in the afterlife. I don't believe that that's how it works. I don't think that that's how God rolls. I think God is a God of grace and he's gracious enough to forgive our errors in thinking and judgment, which we all have, and our errors in theology, which we all have. And so it's not about getting into the right church. It's more about just knowing how much God loves us. And and so I don't know, like, I don't actually know if my path will involve ordination in the Lutheran church. I'm not sure. I don't know whether my calling will be forever to kind of ride this line of dual citizenship. It might be. I'm open to that. All I know is that I need to continue, learning and connecting with God and sharing the things that I learn along the way. I feel like that's, at least for now, what my calling is to do.
What you said, you were called to, you feel called to share this message of grace with, Mormon folks. Do you feel like you can successfully do that in the, I don't know, in the roles or our avenues or places where you're able to do that kind of ministry, so online or wherever, books? Is there a particular place you feel called to go and share that message?
I mean, you know, you asked, do I feel successful? No. Right. You know, and I don't, I don't know that it's about, you know, ever, it's not about necessarily being quote successful, as much as it is opening a space where dialogue and, you know, dialogue can happen. You know, so I do the podcast, like I mentioned, Project Zion with, the Latter-day Seekers team at Community of Christ. And, you know, they're very much like, yeah, talk about whatever you want. You know, that's wonderful over there. So there's some ecumenical work that I think I will continue probably to do with them, as they're very much in a position to be a source of refuge to Mormons who are wounded from their experience with Mormonism. I'm like, technically I'm a perma blogger for Feminist Mormon Housewives. I don't blog there a lot. I'm sorry, Lisa and team. I know I should do better. But yeah, so for now that's, and then in my ward, you know, even here, like just yesterday, Lanny and I spoke in church and I preached him some gospel there. So
can I just interject for a second? So Katie and I, were camping with some friends and things this summer. And I think that just, there was a early morning devotional, and I can't even remember if you were leading it, Katie, or if it was somebody else, I think. And I think that you were speaking really effectively about grace to, you know, a fairly marginalized Mormon crowd. And I think that you know, that's its own ministry, you know, just having a conversation. And it certainly got me thinking more about grace. And Katie and a friend and I recorded a podcast for that recently. And I think that there's a lot that's just telling people they're loved, which sounds really simple, can really be effective when you need to hear it.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I think there's, you know, I think maybe coming out of a Mormon context, we have a sense, well, we don't talk about ministry. We talk about missionary work.
Right.
Right.
And I would not consider the calling that I have to be missionary work, because I don't care what denomination you end up in.
Right. Right.
You know, and instead ministry is, I think, Nancy, what you said, it's coming alongside people. And being with people and being friends with people and having a space where you can talk and you can be real. Because I think that, you know, and I think Nancy, I mean, it was Nancy who kind of, we were having that conversation about grace, and she sort of articulated that, gosh, maybe the core conflict isn't grace versus works, but it's really grace work versus shame. You know,
yeah.
That we're ashamed of who we are. And so we hide and we pretend to be who we're not. And so if you're doing quote unquote ministry, right. Mm-hmm. If what ministry is to like, just be with people and like, let them know that it's safe to be themselves. Like, to me, that's ministry.
Right. I think that's kind of what prompted my original question when I paused there for a moment. I'm just imagining each of us in our different, stations in life. And one of those includes moments in our lives where we were probably hard to get to with the message that you want to share. And I don't know that there's a good answer for this. Maybe there isn't. Maybe you just can't get to those people until they're at a place where they're willing to listen a little bit to a different narrative. But wow, what a great opportunity it would be if there was some kind of avenue where you could, you know, push the pause button on people's life. I guess I'm just thinking, imagine yourself in college under all of that stress and strain. Would you have listened to somebody? Would you have listened to somebody's narrative? Or did it take what you experienced to get yourself ready to hear the message? You know, does that make sense what I'm trying to say? I wish there was a way to package it, or just to be non-confrontational with the idea of, listen to this, think about this idea about grace. And again, like you said, it's not that you want to get somebody to leave their Mormon tradition. Maybe you just want them to think about, you know, God loves you, and some of the shame and guilt that you're carrying around, maybe you don't have to. Sometimes it's hard to get people to hear that, where they're at. So
it is. But I mean, I can say, you know, I was ministered to in those times. I was ministered to very, very, very beautifully by my, I'll probably choke up talking about this. So if you listen to this, I was not expecting to talk about this, but my dear, dear friend, who is one of my very best friends in the world, and she was my Relief Society president at the time, right before my mission, when I was in just complete turmoil, you know?
Right.
And I opened up to her. I didn't open up to many people, you know, my mom and my dad and her, and maybe one or two, maybe that's it.
Right.
About a little bit, you know, what I was experiencing. And, you know, she ministered to me just by listening and just by being there, you know? And so I think that the aha moment, right, that came a few years later, the light bulb moment that happened, couldn't have happened if along the way I hadn't had people in my life who just loved me.
Right, right.
Who just loved me. I had a couple mission companions like that, that they just loved me. And so I hope that, you know, in turn, and that, you know, that I could just be that for other people wherever they're at, you know. mm-hmm. wherever they are.
Right.
Yeah.
And thank you for sharing. I know sometimes those, you know, personal experiences that are very close to your heart are hard to share. So thank you.
Thank you.
For that vulnerability. So it does lead me to one question, just to push a little on, yeah. on that. Since you did find some love from folks that were in your Mormon tradition that you were raised in, why do you think you feel compelled to find a different narrative to share, to bring it back, right? There are examples you said you can share from within the tradition. Maybe talk about why you feel like the message that you've felt compelled by now can't be had in the Mormon faith. Does that make sense as a question?
It does. And I think the answer to that is primarily theological for me. And, you know, as I'm like, I'm really down with the Trinity.
Okay. Oh, good. Get specific. Are there specific truth claims or elements that, yeah, yeah. Those are important to people.
So like, and I'm really, I really believe that. So I just wrote a paper about this. So it's fresh on my mind, but, the idea of God's complete transcendence is something that we don't really have theologically in Mormonism. Hmm. We have God as dude on planet with God's wife, question mark, you know?
Yeah.
And we have this Holy Ghost, and it's like, why is the Holy Ghost in the Godhead when the Holy Ghost is in the body? Da, 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 you know what I mean? But it's like,
right.
This model of God, this way of thinking of God, to me, is not particularly transcendent and awe-inspiring. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that there are not cool things about the idea of God as being an exalted human being, and like there aren't some really neat things that you can do with that. I'm just saying, like, so I don't want it to sound like I'm like, people who believe that are stupid or whatever. It just does not resonate with me because my experience of God, the experience that I have had, is of being kind of held by something completely other and yet completely personal and completely loving. And so to me, God is in and through and is, makes up the entire fabric of existence. And what the Trinity says is that God's very nature is love because you have the three persons of the Trinity, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. But I just learned a cool way of thinking about it and that's not gendered, and that is the Creator, Redeemer, and the, now I'm going to forget what the Spirit was. Dang it!
Testator.
The Spirit. the sustainer, yeah. Right? They are all completely different, completely, completely different, and unified perfectly. And that is love. This complete unity in complete difference is what is love. That's what, when you look at good, healthy relationships, right? Like if you look at like marriage and family therapy, for example, there's a theorist named Bowen, and he talks about he talks about what he calls differentiation. And that is like healthy family systems are when each person is differentiated, each person is like grounded in themselves. They have enough ego strength to sort of withstand the pressures of the family system.
Right.
That when you're differentiated, then from that place of like differentiation, you can create like, you can create a unity or a bond. And so just imagine that like amplified like to the entire universe. And like that is God, right?
Mm. Yeah.
So to me, there is so much there that is so beautiful to think about and to play with and to try and, and just to see the way that that is even in the very fabric of the universe, right? Like you look like an ecosystem is, an ecosystem is an analogy for God, where each species, right, each aspect of the natural creation is completely different and like radically different and crazy, right? There's crazy diversity in the ecosystem, and yet all of that comes together and forms like a whole. And so to have a concept of God that is that is, to me, very resonant and powerful and life-changing. And so that's one reason why I kind of, even though I believe that God can be in Mormonism and is in Mormonism and is in Mormon people, and I'm not telling God what God can and cannot do with God's love. And I'm not saying that there's not important things to learn about God from Mormonism and that there isn't something quite beautiful about also thinking about God as being a lot like us. You know what I mean? Like, that's not a bad idea either. But to me, that the sort of big transcendent other God is something that that really lights my fire. So that's one reason. The other reason, quite frankly, that I couldn't do the whole Mormon thing is I think that the worthiness interviews, I think that the worship of, I think that there's a tendency to worship the leaders. I think that there are structural and institutional policies that are completely antithetical to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so I can't be behind. I can't, I'm just not, it's just not a thing that I'm down with, you know?
But I was wondering if we could kind of wrap up with finishing a little more story.
Yeah. And I was going to say the only other thing that I was going to ask on Nancy's point, for sure, story, whatever you want to share, but also how you navigated all of these changes in the relationships that you have. A lot of people deal with a lot of stress and, you know, even some relationships in jeopardy as a result of transition. So what can you talk about in that respect?
Sure. So absolutely, a faith transition, especially, well, I mean, I don't want to say especially, but certainly coming from a Mormon context can put a lot of strain on your relationships, in particular, like your marriage relationships.
Right, right.
It could be really, really hard in family relationships. I think the best thing that anyone can do is to go slow. Mm-hmm. You know, this process that I've taken has been, you know, about 10 years now, and I would still consider myself very much like in the middle of it. And, mm-hmm. You know, an ongoing process. And you can't just make these like declarations, you know what I mean? Like, especially like in your marriage, you can't just be like, well, this is how it is, and this is how it's going to be, and like, I'm out, and blah, 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 blah. Like, that leaves the other person in such a vulnerable, shocked, and like,
right, right,
difficult place, and they feel rejected. And like, kind of, you did reject them. Like, it's not, they feel rejected for a reason.
Right.
And so, you know, we've had counseling, and, you know, we have talked about things, and it's been hard. It's really hard. It's really hard because each person feels so vulnerable and so exposed, you know, in, right. In the process. Again, I'm talking of a marriage in particular. I can talk about like a broader relationships in a minute too, but if you are in a marriage, you know, there has to be a give and take. There has to be grace. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that starts with doing whatever work on yourself you have to do to get to the place where you are enough at peace with yourself that you can tolerate difference. And that's what I'm talking about, you know, like the theology thing that I was just like kind of rambling on about. That's what I mean. That's what love is, to be grounded enough in yourself that you can tolerate the difference of somebody else and still love and accept that person fully.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you're not, when you're in the throes of an existential crisis, you don't go there first.
Right.
But you keep that in mind, that that's where you've got to get to if you're going to do it in a way that is healthy and that is positive, you know, for your relationships in the end.
Right, right.
And it gives you a lot of opportunity, you know, to work on issues, you know, in your marriage where you might be codependent or you might be avoidant or you might be, you know what I mean? Any number of things. This is a real neat space where you can play and discover where your, you know, where your relationship has room to grow. Speaking of like a marriage in particular.
Right.
I think those same principles apply to just general, you know, your relationships with your family, your relationships with your friends, where it's about, you know, it's about going through the journey and being present with the journey, but recognizing that you're, you know, where you really want to get to, and that it's okay wherever you are, right? It's not a shame thing. It's not a, you're not doing what you should thing, but eventually you want to get to a place where, you know, you're okay enough with yourself to like, okay, so your dad like has some points of view that, you know, you really disagree with. That's okay. You know what I mean? Like, okay, that's my dad. I love him. So.
Right. And I just, I don't know even how to say this. I don't even know if I'll leave it in, but it's hard on the opposite end of that relationship too. And you acknowledge this a little bit when you said that you have to give and take kind of equally. There has to be give and take. I have a good friend who's maybe facing a divorce out of a transition struggle mm-hmm. that he's going through. He's dealing with the issues that he's dealing with, and his spouse isn't willing maybe to listen to him where he's at, where he's going. So I don't know. I don't know if there's anything I can even say or even anything I would even expect for you to say other than I just, my heart goes out to those kinds of situations. It torments me to think about people I care about letting whatever it is that it is that's coming in between them, even if it is something as important to them as their faith. Anyway, I don't know. I just, yeah.
No, you're right. I mean, that's absolutely tragic. And that's one of my, you know, that's one of my gripes with with Mormonism as an institutional, you know, as right. an institution, is that it sets people up to be in this, those situations where they can't be flexible.
Right. Right.
Like, so theologically, like, again, it goes like, theology is important to me, minister, you know, in divinity, yeah. school, but like if your theology is so inflexible that you can't, that and Mormonism can't, like, has a really hard time with difference, a really hard time with difference. You know what I mean? True. Like, we kick out our people
right.
that even disagree a little bit. Like, and so, you know, my heart breaks for folks in that situation too, because I feel like everyone in that situation is hurting and
right.
everyone in that
so.
Situation yeah. is everyone in that situation is probably coming from a place where they're trying to do what is right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they just have been taught a thing is love. That's not love. Right. That's not really love.
Yeah.
And that sucks. It sucks. It sucks if you are trying to be loving and the person like can't be. And you can't make someone be loving.
Right.
You know?
Well, and like you said, I think people are legitimately hurting on the other side because you were this one thing for so long for them. Mm-hmm. And you shared something that was very special and intimate in that mm-hmm. relationship. And I think there are extreme, profound intimacies in a Mormon marriage and relationship, even with the theology of sealing and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
So for somebody to step away, sometimes it does feel very violent to be saying, hey, you know, this sealing thing, those promises we made, maybe I don't know that those are necessary promises or et cetera, right? People can take it in a lot of different ways. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Your comment that legitimate pain can be experienced by all is profound and worth all of us stepping back to consider in all the relationships that we have with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
Anyway, final words, anything else that you want to share that we didn't get to that you felt like you wanted to talk about or anything at all that we didn't cover?
I mean, I guess I would just say, you know, I mean, Nancy had asked a little bit about, you know, well, the story, like what's the end of the story or whatever. And I think that the end of the story is that it's being written, you know, and so flexibility, openness, grace, space, love, those are the things, that's what it's about. And the process of a faith transition is gut-wrenching and it sucks worse than anything in the world to have your worldview, you know, well, it doesn't suck worse than anything in the world. There are things that suck worse than a faith transition. You know what I mean? There's like starving people in the world and right. things like that. So I don't want to be too hyperbolic, but it's a really crappy thing.
Right.
And it's really hard and it hurts really bad. And having your worldview kind of torn to bits and, you know, and having all of that kind of just scattered around you and your relationships uncertain and everything like that. I mean, it's really, really painful. And so I think the only thing that I would want to say is like, just acknowledge that. I would just want to acknowledge the truth of that pain, that that is real. And it's hard. And I would also add to that, that it's also a place where you can be transformed in a way that is very profound. And it's an opportunity in some ways, at the same time that it's a terrible thing, can be an opportunity for growth and for love and for grace. And if you're like me, it's also a place where you can meet God.
Yeah. Thank you.
For sure.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing this story with us.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. I hope I didn't ramble too much. I don't know if I felt like I rambled a little bit.
We can say we're done and we can just chat for a sec, but yeah, I really appreciate it. I thought it was all perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. No, there was, it's a good story. And thank you for being willing to share the OCD with us. Because I think that just being really frank about the problems that that caused you and how, you know, there is like, initially it seems as though you're confusing it with like a spiritual problem. I hear so much of that in my ward where people have a mental health issue and themselves or people around them are somehow confusing it with a spiritual issue.
Yeah.
And I wish that that didn't happen these days, but it does. And so I think that's really valuable.
Yeah. When I spoke in church yesterday in the ward, I very deliberately talked about anxiety and depression that I had experienced and then commended everyone to therapy because I know that that's a stigma, you know? And so I thought, well, here's an opportunity to not just share, you know, to share a message of grace, but also to model.
Right.
What does it look like when you're like, when you've accepted the reality of your situation? And part of that modeling is there's a stigma, and there's a stigma in all of society against mental illness, but in Mormonism, that stigma exists in Mormon culture. And so to model for people, hi, I'm Katie, I'm really healthy, and I have a mental illness. Like, to me, that was an important thing to do and to talk about openly.
I agree.
Yeah, there's unfortunate an entirely unfortunate narrative or rhetoric around, you know, people who need some kind of counseling being broken, or there's some problem with that. And there's a lot of folks that could, including myself, who benefit from that outlet. It's nice to have somebody to talk to and somebody who's trained to give you suggestions that are, you know, not just based on spur of the moment good thinking, but some clinical solutions to problems that really exist.
Yep.
With all the different faith transitions that we've heard so far, they're all really different.
Yeah.
And while still having some common elements to them, But it's important to see that, like, the individuality of these stories, that they're real stories, mm-hmm. that people really experience the things they experience. And
right.
It's just really helpful. But thank you for being a guest for us.
And I think it was fantastic. You said your story's not done. It's being written. I think people need to hear that and allow them that space to, to go, oh, I don't have to have everything figured out, tied up in a bow, perfect at this moment. Stuff's just happening. Yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, if you can get, maybe you could put this in, if you could get good at one thing, you know, if you could use your faith transition to get good at one thing, I would suggest that that thing be accepting what is happening in the present moment.
Right.
And just letting the present moment be what it is.
Right. Yeah.
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 And not trying to say, well, where am I going to end up? What am I going to, you know, and not trying to all the just
right.
to just let yourself be
right.
in that moment. And that, to me, that is grace. That is what grace is just accepting, you know, what is present with love.
And the only thing I'd say is if those moments, you're in those moments and they are painful or they're hard, know that there is love, right? Just to reiterate that fact that whether or not you accept grace in a divine sense, there are people, absolutely. Including us here, though I don't know all of you out there who are listening, there is a sense of love coming from me, hopefully, that you pick up on that we share in this story together. This human experience is not something we do alone. No person's an island. Anyway, so thank you.
Absolutely. Cool.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Faith Transitions. Join the conversation on our website, faithtransitions.com, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. Chariot of fire, we'll sing and we'll shout with the
armies of heaven. Hosanna, Hosanna. This podcast is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ. The views expressed in this podcast are the opinions of those speaking and do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or official stance of Community of Christ or the Latter-day Seekers team.